Dave Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. The Daily Maverick Show is proudly delivered to you by Postnet Courier.
Dora from Delmas sent documents to Dana in Dallas. Tandiwe sent toys from Tabazimbi to Toronto. Both used Postnet Global Express. They chose from 8 different box sizes, packed their items in their boxes, and their parcels were delivered directly to their international destinations. Postnet Global Express delivers to-door anywhere worldwide. It's easy, affordable, and convenient. Plus, you can track your parcel online. There are over 300 Postnet stores nationwide. Locate your nearest store at postnet.co.za.
Good afternoon. It's just after 1.05 p.m. Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. My name is Kingsley Kipuri, and as usual, I'll be with you for the next hour. You know, you can tweet us to get involved in the conversation on @DMShowZA. Give us a call on 0861-555-189. I'm joined in studio by my comrade Greg Nicholson.
I'm Andla.
And Fatima Matiba, who's usually on social media making it happen. Fatima, welcome as usual.
Thanks, Kay.
So before we get started, you saw the rain and the hail the other day. You saw the heat wave last week. Do you guys think it is the end of the world? Is it the rapture?
The end of the world?
Yes.
I thought the end of the world was because of the drought, so now it's the end of the world
because
of too much rain.
If you studied on your revelations, when these things all come together, these are the signs of the end of days. Nope.
Positive note. Another positive note to start the show on.
Okay, perfect. I'll just set up a different show on it and we can discuss this, the symbols of the second coming of Christ. And so that's my homework. Okay, anyway, as for today's show, first we'll be talking about transformation in the legal profession, and we've got a great sort of set of guests lined up to actually explore this issue that really blew up a few weeks ago during the silicosis case. We'll also be talking about Kenyan corruption and what's going on there. We had a journalist who was held for reporting and speaking about corruption going on in the state, so we'll be speaking to John Girashu about that. And lastly, we'll be talking to Ernest Nkosi, who's a director of a film, Tina Sobabili, and that's being tipped to potentially be in line for an Oscar. So is that something that's going to happen, and what is the work and effort that went into this sort of great story of making that film come together? But first, transformation in law. This is something that, you know, came to the public conversation a few weeks ago during the silicosis case, when one of the people, Richard Spoor, involved with the case, put up a social media post about why he was unable to have enough black people and black advocates and black attorneys as part of the team. And it really started this great conversation of why don't we have enough black people in a industry that's as important, as strategic to the country, to the constitution, and to everything that we aspire to be as a country. So we're going to be speaking to people a lot more qualified and informed than I am. First, we'll be speaking to Advocate Makhlape Selo, the Secretary of Advocates for Transformation, Johannesburg. Advocate, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And secondly, someone who I'm hoping we now have on the line, Siham Samai from the National Association for Democratic Lawyers. Siham, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
Okay, perfect. So firstly, both welcome you to the show and for making time for us. And I'd just love to get sort of an introductory answer from the both of you. We'll start with you, Advocate Makhlape. I mean, we hear some really worrying statistics about the number of black people who are not only in the field, but who are senior in the field. And I'd love if you could give us an idea of what those numbers look like and why is this the case? Why do we have this lack of representation and transformation in the legal field?
I think if we are to talk about lack of transformation in the profession, we can talk about it at two levels. Mm. The first would be representativity. Within the profession. And on the second level, it would be transformation involving those already within the field. As regards your question as to why the numbers are low, I think it's not necessary for us to unpack our history, but you must accept that as at 1994, the figures were traditionally very, very low. And if you were to go actually further back than that, at least 30 years, black people were not even permitted to practice in the same building as white advocates. So that basically is the background against which we must have this discussion. There has been an increase since 1994 of entry into the profession by people of color and by women. but what happened at least until 2005, the numbers entering the profession were pretty low. So the number of people taken for pupillage were rather low if you compare white males to black males completely. And by black, I mean both Indian, African, and colored. Mm. And if you further compare them to females, firstly, white females, and lastly, black females. Black females had the lowest record of admission. Then you, once they are admitted, you then have to look at the nature of the practice in the first 3 years. Normally with us at the bar, the first 3 years are the more or less the deciding years. It's a make it or break it period. And we found that the level of attrition in the first 5 years is highest amongst black females, followed by black males. So they simply do not have sufficient flow of work to sustain a practice. And hard as they may hold on to the dream of becoming an advocate, they are forced to face the realities and bow out and go find other work or be employed. So that is the numbers issue. Then there is transformation on a different level, which is, of those that stay, what is the caliber of work they are exposed to and they get to do? So much that when you, as an outsider, you are looking at what an average 5, 10, 15-year-old advocate looks like or what their practice looks like, must you do that with reference to a black man, to a black female, to a female, or to white males? Because you can never have a singular answer. A white man at 10 years at the bar has got a level of practice that very few, I mean, minuscule number of black men can match. If you then try and compare the 10-year-old white males at the bar with black females, then it is actually even ridiculous. So there is transformation on that level as well, which is the quality and the type of work that practitioners get exposed to, and therefore the rate at which they are able to develop the forensic skill of their chosen profession.
I mean, thanks for that, you know, really in-depth, I mean, overview. A lot I want to jump into there. But first, Siham, I'd love to hear from you. When we ask, you know, we're hearing a lack of transformation and representation. Why are we in this situation? Why is it like this?
Well, I think that I'm most probably going to concur with what the advocate was saying. Mm. But just firstly, I mean, Adal has embarked on a dialogue with different women lawyers, advocates within the legal profession to be able to find out what are these multidimensional type of challenges which they face. But one thing we need to recognize is that the legal profession is a microcosm of our broader society. And we need to be able to reflect on the challenge of gender transformation and equality as a country. And then we need to be able to reflect inwards on our own development in order to ensure that we reflect outwardly the vision of our constitution. And that is for the entire legal profession. So gender issues are prevalent everywhere, and it remains a product of our community and dominant cultures. Now, within the legal profession, and it's something which the advocate touched on, is that, and maybe I should just make it clearer, is that our justice system, or whether or not our legal profession, are still dominated, for example, by issues of patriarchy, white supremacy, as well as privilege. And it's something which we need to acknowledge. Then also the roles of women within South Africa, gender inequality, where the ability of women is questioned and presumed to always be inferior to other, either male, black males. So how does this relate to specifically to the legal profession also, is that women lawyers, that they are senior, but they're not senior partners, nor are they senior counsel. And they are completely excluded from certain areas of law because they are assumed to be more emotional to handle certain areas of law. And all they have to be is possibly family lawyers, children, law, within children rights environment, etc. Because that is the closest to the stereotypical role. within the community. So certain presumptions exist within our profession, and it needs to be unlearned before we can properly move forward. And I think this is one of the challenges that we need to look at 20 years into democracy, that we do have the procedural laws, we do have policies, etc. But there's many things that need to unlearn, the profession has to unlearn to be able to ensure that the women lawyers are effective within the legal profession.
Advocate, I'd like to hear your experience on, if you could tell us about perhaps some examples of what you've seen. Just now we heard that there are systems of patriarchy and white privilege that continue to exclude black and female lawyers. And you mentioned the level of attrition is highest amongst black women and in those early years. And then the example of so if there's a white man who gets 10 years into his career, his practice is going to probably be much more advanced on average than his black counterpart. Can you give us some examples as to how that happens? Is it briefing patterns? Is it that they don't get the work? How does it work for these young advocates, young attorneys?
Young attorneys or young advocates? It's two different things.
So I think it's actually that whole process of I've made it into the field, but you're saying at 10 years, somebody who's black has less experience and is less qualified than somebody on the other side. So what are those different stages that result in somebody having sort of poorer or less experience after the 10 years?
I think it, and this will sound very basic, but it is this basic. It's access to opportunity, it's access to work. As with any profession, ours is based on experience. The more you get exposed to certain kind of work, the more you sharpen your knives and the better you become. Now, you will find in most instances, particularly with black people, it's not impossible that for 5 years they're running a particular gambit, which is the same kind of work, and that is their only source of work. Like, let's say, a road accident fund kind of work. Now, not that it is not useful or that you do not acquire any skill, but I'm sure you'll admit that you can do it so long and no further, particularly when you're not interested in specializing in that field and you require exposure to other kinds of legal work so that you can develop your other skills. But what happens is that because of the absence of sufficient flow of work, people end up being stuck in one field, not exactly of their choosing, and they get stuck in a rut. Now, predominantly with white males, they have the advantage that their development is consistent with their number of years at the bar. If they start, let's say, with work such as road accident fund, in no time they have expanded their field and they are dealing with other issues. And the longer they stay at the bar, the more experienced they become, the more complex the issues they deal with. But you don't find that that doesn't necessarily translate to everybody at the bar. So at the end of the day, when you look at somebody at 5 years and you expect them to have a particular level of skill, and think you should be able to throw anything at them, difficult as it may be, they will not drown. They will be able to deal with the matter. You find that doesn't necessarily extend to black people, and you wonder why that is so, and it's simply because they haven't had appropriate exposure.
And what happens specifically? You say they're not able to break out. In this example is the road accident fund. So what happened? What kind of networks and access? What do you think is that sort of missing pin?
Okay. The representative from NADEL spoke of two important things, which is patriarchy first, but I think I would like to qualify it and say white patriarchy. And then it's a question of networks. So for anyone who comes to the bar with absolutely no networks within the legal profession, and more importantly with attorneys, because we are briefed by attorneys, and doesn't have networks with institutional clients in particular, finds it very difficult to break into the system. So it ends up being a white men's gentleman's club which is if you do get exposure either to the attorneys or to the high net worth clients, particularly institutional clients, you then have to be invited into the network. And who issues that invitation is basically who dominates, and these would be the white males.
I hear you. See, how I wanted to ask especially about a research that you were part of at Nadel about gender transformation in the legal field. We're talking a lot about race. Now, I'm curious how specifically on gender, are there any sort of differences you see in a different kind of prejudice or disadvantage towards the female or black female advocates? And what does that look like in concrete terms? What are they experiencing?
I mean, obviously, we had four dialogues already, and we're still going to have another two this year. Because we're moving in terms of all the provinces. But certain patterns that have been emerging is that women are able to reflect on the interconnectivity of the racial transformation and gender transformation within the legal profession. Although there is a clear sense that women, although they come from like different professions within the legal fraternity, they are shared and similar obstacles and barriers. But it's multi-sectional and but it's also different. So women reflected on how their gendered roles in society still prejudice them and prejudice in respect of motherhood, care responsibilities. There was also reflection on the lack of support systems and presumptions which is within the legal profession and structures for women seeking to enter the profession and where that duty actually rests. Because I think one of the challenges is that if they speak to substantive equality, we speak about equality of outcome, equality of opportunity. And within the current paradigm, we're moving from the wrong premise, is how do we promote that access for black women within the legal profession? And we don't want to come from a rural area, and we haven't even discussed other forms of discrimination which women face, LGBTI communities, also within that particular environment. So those are all challenges that we are looking at within this dialogue. And I say these are only issues that are coming out of the five dialogue sessions that we had thus far. There's a lot of presumptions, and those presumptions obviously have to be unlearned around competency, around work, around access, about networks. Networks is a major, major challenge, and it's something which has come out of all the dialogue sessions. It's the type of support structures that the organized legal profession and even the departments are giving women to be able to ensure that there's access. So that support structures is very important, because women lawyers come in without that particular network. Mm, mm. And how does government, how does the organized profession create that network and opportunities? And that is a major challenge.
Mm, hey, thanks, Siam. Advocate, I think you wanted to jump in there.
well, not exactly jump in, because I fully agree with what she says. Yes. I just wanted to touch again on the issue we're just discussing, which is the issue of networks.
Yeah.
Now, an interesting phenomenon has developed in the country, and I'm speaking strictly from an advocate's perspective, we are litigators being advocates, and the state is the biggest litigator in the country, and we are now sitting here 21 years after democracy discussing these difficulties as if an institution such as the state is not in power and is not the biggest litigator in the country. Considering our numbers at the bar, you would have expected that we should not be having problems of networking, at least insofar as the state itself is concerned. And by the state, I mean the state in its broadest context. This includes state-owned enterprises. This includes the state at all levels. So what you find instead happening is the very briefing patterns that are very skewed when the client is a private sector client, like with companies. That same practice is now perpetuating within the state. When we talk of networks, for instance, part of the networking is knowing and being exposed to as many attorneys as possible. Now, if the state is not developing black attorneys and is not giving them appropriate exposure, and I say this remembering that I think the only branch of law the state is not involved in is family law in terms of litigation, but every other branch is well represented. If the black attorneys are not given an opportunity by the state, then it means that black advocates cannot network with black attorneys and get to know them better. And, you know, so it is the same. It's the same process, except that this time it involves the state. And I think that is about the most disappointing aspect of it. One would have expected that 21 years into democracy, we would be debating briefing patterns insofar as they relate to private clients, but not the state. Mm. But unfortunately, we continue to.
I know that some of the cases I've been at reporting, when you see the states involved, are very high-profile individuals from the state. It is quite sort of shocking when, you know, it's sort of surprising to see this whole white, usually old white male team. I remember at the Matakana Commission, I think Dalian Mpofu particularly pointed out that situation with, I think it was Cyril Ramaphosa, the deputy president's legal team. But I'm wondering from both of you, I think we were talking before this and about how perhaps we could change it. And one of the issues that Fatima raised was the Legal Practices Act, which, if I understand it, it reduces the barriers and the gatekeeping in terms of briefing advocates, whether that has made or could make any difference, as well as the bar's recent declaration that, and I don't know the exact details, but is it a team of three advocates must have at least one black person on the team? Mm. Will these efforts make any sort of difference?
All
right, just a resolution, because I think it will be a quicker one. We hope it will make a difference. Will it make an earth-shattering difference? We don't think so. And it was not put forward at the AGM on the understanding that, you know, it's the alpha and omega of the problems we are facing. It is but one of the many steps we can take. I must point out that, you know, the bar is a self-regulating body. And we've got a constitution which basically... it dictates how members must behave within this association on a number of levels, and except insofar as it relates to transformation. So the bar itself did not recognize the need to have transformation as an element that the bar must monitor and must enforce. So this is just the first step, because at least now the resolution as adopted renders it professional misconduct to have a team of three or more where no black person is represented. Now, will it resolve all our problems? No, because it's not like we do not appreciate that it is not in the majority of cases that you have teams of three or more. Most cases it's one man shows, or at most two, and the resolution doesn't extend that far. But at least to that little percentage, we trust that it will make a difference.
Okay. Advocate Mahlap is not convinced. Siham, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I just wanted to say that, I mean, one of the positive things about the Legal Practice Act is that we find ourselves now in a larger repo process. And what we can do is that we can assist, maybe make submissions to the current National Legal Forum to facilitate a paradigm shift with the impetus is not just on numbers as an indicator of transformation. It's something which the advocate acknowledged and just identified, but where women and gender equality find substantive rights of enjoyment, protection, and promotion. And that is very important, because we are within that space now where we'll be able to engage with the professional body. Mm-hmm. So this particular research we are looking at is to guide that dialogue engagement with these professional bodies, because the fact is, 20 years down the line, we are women, so black women are not on the same playing field, and we need to acknowledge that. We have been playing within a field which wasn't our field in the first place, and we need to be able to make structures accountable to be able to ensure that there is an inclusive approach.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the issues that we need to look at is that provisions and programs must give preferential treatment to members, to women groups considered to have been discriminated and disadvantaged in the past. And we do not have the advantage of another 300 to 400 years to make it right. And that is what we need to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be made right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what we look at seems to be these type of measures, it is a manifestation of our right to equality, of our substantive rights. And it must not be seen as a limitation of that particular right. And that is where we need to do that paradigm shift. It is very important when we start engaging with the new structures that should be the new mindset when we move forward, so that it can be an inclusive environment for women, and in particularly black women.
Strong remarks. Advocate Makhlap, I think you have some closing remarks to close us off.
In fact, I was just going to add a word to that and fully agree. And if the act is to have delivered anything, it would at least deliver that. Because I think as self-governing bodies, we have proven that we are incapable of doing it ourselves. 10 years ago, 2005, the Bar commissioned a very expensive investigation and report. We call it the Deloitte Report. And that report recommended the very issues that she is talking about.
Mm.
But we shelved it away and nothing happened. So maybe through the act, we just might achieve something.
Thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Siham Samai, Advocate Makhlap Eselo, thank you so much for making time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Perfect. We're into a quick commercial break and then we'll be right back. Remember, today's Daily Maverick Show is brought to you by Postnet Courier.
Today, Patty from Parais sent Christmas presents to Paris. Graham from Grahamstown sent gifts to Chomotso and Gaborone. Both used Postnet Global Express. They chose from 8 different box sizes, packed their items in their boxes, and their parcels were delivered directly to their international destinations. Postnet Global Express delivers two-door anywhere worldwide. It's easy, affordable, and convenient. Plus, you can track your parcel online. There are over 300 Postnet stores nationwide. Locate your nearest store at postnet.co.za.
If you'd like.
Good afternoon. You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. If you're just tuning in, remember you can tweet us on @DMShowZA. You can call us on 0861-555-189. Yes, I got that right. Fantastic. Now, we're just switching topics. We want to talk about some corruption stories that have been coming out of Kenya. So we've recently had a few breaking stories, and we want to really dig into what's going on. Is corruption actually increasing, or is it just perhaps more reporting? And we actually had, or seeing perhaps a more aggressive approach from the state to journalists and other people reporting on this. With us from Kenya, we'll be talking to John Girashu, a senior reporter at the Daily Nation. John, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Perfect. John, sorry for the long wait. Thanks for holding.
Okay,
perfect. John, I'd love if you could walk us through some of the work you've been writing on and reporting on around corruption in Kenya, and how it came about that sort of you had a running with the CID, the Criminal Investigation Department, and if you just walk us through what happened there.
We have been, because we are parliamentary reporters, but the Public Accounts Committee here has been looking at the Auditor General's statement of accounts for the year 2013-2014.
Hmm.
So out of that, we have been getting information from those meetings about what would appear to be corruption, material that was procured at inflated prices, and in the case that I have been questioned about, the apparent refusal by a ministry to provide documents supporting some transactions in that ministry. So from that, from the last one, it was actually on the Interior Ministry, which is the ministry responsible for national security.
Hmm.
So when it was asked some questions and we had that in the meeting, we wrote about it, and the minister got angry with us, and that's how he ended up accusing us of getting information from what he thought was a privileged or a classified meeting, and then writing about it.
Okay, I hear you. And what kind of questions were being asked when you're being questioned about this? What was the response? Was it aggressive? Were there any threatening of arrest? And when you were held, what was that experience like?
It was not a good experience because it is a restriction of my freedom. At one point, they took my phone away. It was not really a good experience. But on the other hand, the police also appeared to be under some sort of pressure they are not used to. So that also appeared to annoy them and to have them doing work that is not really part of their mandate.
I mean, John, you've been doing sort of this line of work for a while. Are you seeing a Kenyan state that is perhaps more aggressive or suspicious or unwelcoming to your field, to journalists and journalists alike who are trying to uncover stories and report on issues, some of which will be around corruption and maladministration by the state? Do you feel like they're getting more aggressive on these issues?
Yeah, we've always had concerns from way back in 2013 that the government was coming up with laws that would amount to restricting our freedom. In fact, we have two of those laws that were eventually passed in 2013 and which have since been challenged in court by journalists themselves. But increasingly, despite that, we have seen other laws also coming in which are which would make our work very difficult. There was one in December last year about that required us to seek permission from the police to publish photographs from scenes of terror attacks. That was also beaten down by the court, but it was part of a pattern that is evident up to now.
I mean, that sounds really worrying. I'm curious, John, where do you think it's coming from? Because, I mean, you've already mentioned it seems like the insecurity in Kenya, you know, post the Westgate attacks and post the Garissa attacks seems to be at play with the state's thinking. But could you give us maybe just some insight into what you think is informing this government aggression and antagonism towards journalism?
I think we have some people within government who have not yet embraced the ideas of the constitution passed in 2010. So they are bringing what we call an old school mentality to a modern world. And there are unfortunately people who share that position and have been encouraging them to come up with that thing. And for me, the worrying part is that the authorities or the people who are in charge of them, they don't catch these things early enough. So that they end up in Parliament where I am right now, and they, like in December last year, they ended up causing a national embarrassment with MPs fighting in the chamber.
I remember that. That was quite. I remember scenes of MPs fighting and people, you know, I think somebody threw their underwear at somebody else at some point. John, I wanted to ask about a press release from Cabinet Secretary Nkaiseri around it seemed to be targeted at you know, Twitter activists and journalists, and it almost seems like they are seeing reporting on the state and reporting on corruption as almost a threat to the stability of the country, and are saying that this is part of some kind of international campaign or conspiracy to undermine or destabilize the Kenyan government. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think it's a product of a fertile imagination, because I personally haven't been approached by anybody or told by anybody that we want to bring down the government and this is the information that we have to use. And in fact, all that information has been put forward in public meetings. Had it been a case of someone plotting to topple the government, sure meetings like those will be held away from the public. Yeah, but this is information that is coming from an independent body, the Office of the Auditor General, being handled by another independent body, that's the National Assembly, rather by a committee in the National Assembly. So I'll say those old school, old fashioned people who would repeat what was said by dictators in the past, in the 1980s, and before our country got into democracy in 1992.
And I hear you, John. Sorry, if you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. We're talking to John Girashu, Kenyan journalist who was held by the Criminal Investigation Department for reporting on corruption. I mean, now, John, when you look at all these things holistically, the issues coming out of different ministries, you know, devolution, the National Youth Service, interior ministries. Do you feel like there's actually an increase in corruption, or are journalists perhaps getting better at reporting on it and finding out what's going on? Or do you, because it feels, when you watch the news and read the newspapers, it feels like there's been a massive increase in corruption. Is that actually the case?
To some extent, yes. I've been told by people in government before that when the budget of a ministry is doubled from 1 year to the next, let's say last year you're getting 4 billion shillings, and the following year you get 16. There is no capacity in that department to absorb that money. And what happens is the money now starts getting taken by people who find that it is there in plenty. The budget has been approved by Parliament, and there are more opportunities to take it. You know, like if you had a budget for 4 billion, you are maybe only paying salaries, trailing vehicles, and maintaining your office. But when it comes to 16 or even 10, you have to have projects that you're undertaking, you have to have increased procurement. And I think that's where now people get a chance to take this money. What we call in Kenya, to eat this money.
Because
it's available, and the systems are not capable of absorbing it, and there's a lot of the pressure from whoever appointed the government to deliver, to show that things are working. So in that process, you get give people a very rich environment for which to benefit.
And I hear you, Jordan. It's really worrying to watch. I mean, I'm curious about a report that recently came out by, I think it was Journalists for Justice, about the Kenya Defence Force and their operations in Somalia as part of AMISOM. And they're painting a picture of an army that's not doing very much, you know, protecting and fighting. And they seem to be, you know, almost running taxes on people involved in the charcoal industry, in the sugar industry. How is that being received, you know, in Kenya, and is that a blow to the government's portrayal of them trying to do whatever they can to fight terror?
Yes, I'll say it causes a lot of damage to the credibility of the army and the credibility of the army, because when the army was sent there was a lot of campaigns tell us, to inform us Kenyans that going there was the right thing to do. But we have not seen anything that tells us that this money, that the campaign is going to stop at any time. We don't know, and we are not kept abreast of what the army is doing there. So when such a report comes out, it can only do damage. But also, we have not had the opportunity as journalists to go in Somalia as independent actors and find out the extent of this or whether it is true. Because of the basic reason, logistics of getting there, and you would not be operating in a safe environment.
I mean, I hate you, John. I mean, I think my final question before we let you go, I know you're reporting from Parliament today, is just, I mean, what do you think is missing? How do we create a Kenya where the journalists and the government are able to work together to, you know, to have an informed democracy and actually, you know, fight corruption and curb insecurity? What do you think is the way forward on filling what seems to be a mistrust between the, you know, different crucial bodies in a functioning democracy?
That's a tough question. But I think if information was made more accessible, I think we also need in Kenya right now the jailing of a big person. The taking to task of an important person for being involved in corruption. I think in Kenya you'd be jailed like three big people whose names are always in the paper. I think the public will begin to see that that sort of crime does not pay. But as for the long term, I don't know whether I'm being a typical journalist, but I don't think there's any much hope right now.
I hear you. I put you on the spot a bit. Anyway, John Girashu, thank you so much for making time for us. I'll let you get back to what you need to do.
Okay,
perfect. Thank you. If you're just tuning in, it's a Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. We're just going into the last portion of the show. Next, we'll be talking to filmmaker Ernest Nkosi about his film Tina Sobabili, Greg, I'd actually like to hand over this to you. I know you watched the film. I know you're quite interested in this. So I'd love to, if you could welcome Ernest and take it from here.
Ernest, are you there? Can you hear us?
I'm here. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. How are you doing?
Well, fantastic. Very happy to be speaking to you guys.
Thanks for joining us. Now, let's just jump straight into it. The National Film and Video Foundation recently selected Tina Sobobile as its nomination to the Oscars for I think, the best foreign language film. It's no problem. I was saying the National Film and Video Foundation recently selected Tina Sobobile, your movie, as its nomination to the Oscars for, I think, the best foreign language film.
That's true.
Can you just tell us about, number one, how that feels? I'm sure it must be a great honor. And number two, what the next steps are in seeing whether this becomes an official Oscar-nominated film?
Okay, first part of your question, we were extremely excited. We got picked over, I think there was a good 8 films that were submitted, and to come out top sort of that bunch was exciting. But before that, about 3 weeks ago, we got the nod to enter our film into the Golden Globes. So we've got the Golden Globes coming up and then the actual Oscar itself. So we are en route on Monday off to LA to campaign for the Golden Globes. We've got our official screening on the 27th of November.
Wow.
And then, it's just a really, it's extremely exciting time, nerve-wracking time. We've been doing this independently throughout the way, and it's a miracle that we've managed to reach this far.
And what does that entail, going to campaign for a Golden Globe? How does that work?
You gotta meet the foreign in the Golden Globes. You gotta meet the foreign press. You gotta give your screeners. They gotta basically feed you, poke you, ask you questions that they have about the film, just to make sure that you are the right candidate, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's a full-court press of campaigning to get that nomination and the eventual win.
Now, and if I'm correct, this is your first feature film, right?
This is true, yes.
So, and you've won awards at the Josie, Rwanda, Pan-African, Urban World Film Festivals.
Yeah,
and now there's all this. How are you dealing with all these successes? It must be pretty overwhelming.
I think not to sound otherwise, but the successes have been very deserved. For us, this is now a 5-year project ongoing because we had to raise the money ourselves. So every cent we put into the film, that was ourselves. So that was years of going without, and it's nice to finally be recognized for that effort, And we shot the film in 7 days, full on crew, full everything.
Wow.
Released it independently to 14 screens. Became 8th in box office, beating the only South African independent film to come 8th. It's the only time we'll ever be happy about coming 8th. to come 8th at box office, I mean, some of those Hollywood budgets that we Hollywood films we beat, their budgets are ridiculous. I mean, the poster budget is the equivalent of our entire production budget.
Now, tell us a little bit about the journey to get here. You're sort of alluding to it now, but from what I understand, the whole crew and the whole team involved in this thing were all under 30. You self-financed it. It took you, seven years, is that right?
It took us 4 years to
four years.
Get the financing.
Mm-hmm.
We are now on year 6.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we had to make the film and then get the film to the qualifying festivals, and then this is now year 2. We made the film last year, we released it this year, and we're still going.
Mm. That journey, though, while you didn't have finance, while you're just sort of really trying to keep on pushing this thing, that must have been really hard at times.
Yeah, extremely difficult, because, I mean, like, who's going to take a chance on some unknown director with a crazy script that deals with sugar daddy, you know, which are like all taboo topics on the South African continent. So it was the decision to fund it didn't come out of Cape Town, but it came from a lot of rejection and a lot of no's, you know. But the story was strong enough that we needed to do whatever needed to be done in order to get the story told.
and to be sitting here now talking to you is literally a testament to that never dying spirit of I can do it no matter what.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, Ernest, I'm curious about the goodwill that sometimes came your way. I was reading in the newspaper the other day, and I'd love if you could just tell the story of when you had to go to the States and Vancouver and being stuck in an airport.
Oh,
and, that was such a crazy story. Could you please tell that?
Yeah, so you were basically stranded at JFK because our funding didn't come through, and we needed that funding to get to Canada.
Mm.
And we were 3 weeks away from our departure day. Somehow we managed to get to Vancouver, but I was flying from JFK to Phoenix. And in Phoenix, I was detained because they thought there was fraudulent activity on my credit card. And needless to say, I left the credit card with the other guys. You know, we all had to travel from four different places because we all couldn't get on the same flight. So I had traveled first. I traveled first so I could make our screening, which was the very next day. So I was going to make the screening at 1 p.m. And the police detained me and interrogated me for about 3 hours. And then eventually the festival vouched for me and I was let go. But before being let go, I was banned from flying on American Airways. So I found myself stranded in Phoenix. So I'm stranded in Phoenix. With no credit card, because the guys have the credit card. Everybody's flying. So I literally was grounded in Phoenix for the 3 hours. Till eventually, I got a flight on Air Alaska. But that flight had to fly from Phoenix to Seattle, Portland to Portland, Vancouver. So in one day, I was on 4 flights. Needless to say, I missed my screening and only arrived in Vancouver at 1 a.m. the next day. So, so it was, just getting there was a journey and a half.
Jeez, what a story. And you mentioned that there would just seem to be, you know, people coming to the party along the way and people offering accommodation and food. And is that something that you found?
Yeah, I mean, just the goodwill. I mean, by the time we arrived in Canada, I mean, the story was all over the festival. Yo, these guys.
These are the guys. Those are the crazy guys. Yeah.
Ended up at Guantanamo Bay. You know? So people were very interested, and then when they found out that we was a South African entry into the office, even more interest came. And then a few days into that trip, we found out about the Golden Globe.
Jeez.
And we literally packed our screening, like 250 people.
Wow.
Absolutely amazing. And I mean, these people don't know South Africa from a bar, so, and for them to come out like that in those numbers is really humbling. And the film played amazingly. They absolutely loved it, you know, and from there we managed to get a lot more contact, people introducing us to people, will you meet this person, send your, I mean, now we're going to have a story in the Hollywood Reporter,
wow.
So stuff like that, which all helped with the traction of us campaigning for these two major awards, because even though we can't compete traditionally with the other films, like our story is powerful enough to get us that recognition, and not only recognition, but just a fair chance to review, fail, and then decide from there. Already, if you're an African film, you're dealing with, I'm not really going to watch it.
Mm-hmm. Ernest, before you mentioned the movie is, you know, one of the key issues that it's about is sugar daddies, but it also seems to, I think, for me, it also deals with family and friendship and those relationships, as well as violence and you know, quite particularly life, I guess, in a township and in this case, Alex.
Yeah.
But I sort of watched it and I really enjoyed it. I loved it, but I found it hard to put my finger on exactly what I liked about it so much. What do you think? What is it that you think that sort of has really created the success? Is it the acting? Is it the sugar daddy aspect?
No, I think it's showing people from the township in that light, because they never get seen as, I mean, most people that are in affluent South Africa only drive around the township or drive to, never actually understand that these people have lives and there's issues that concern the same people that drive around from the same people that drive through, and all have similarities, all have commonalities that are when highlighted, people are like, wow, actually, I didn't know that we share that common bond. So for me, it would be the portrayal of people that live in the township like this, in an authentic way, from someone who grew up in a similar township.
Ernest, what a great story, man. We're really behind you 100%, and we really look forward to seeing the movie continue to achieve greater heights, and also to see you continue to grow as a filmmaker. So a big congratulations, and thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the support.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. Thank you for tuning in. Please download and share the podcast. You know where to find us next week, 1 to 2 p.m., The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Today's show was proudly delivered to you by Postnet Courier. See you next week.
Dora from Delmas sent documents to Dana in Dallas. Tandiwe sent toys from Tabazimbi to Toronto. Both used Postnet Global Express. They chose from 8 different box sizes, packed their items in their boxes, and their parcels were delivered directly to their international destinations. Postnet Global Express delivers to-door anywhere worldwide. It's easy, affordable, and convenient. Plus, you can track your parcel online. There are over 300 Postnet stores nationwide. Locate your nearest store at postnet.co.za.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.